WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. UVA's new president answers questions from Virginia lawmakers. After a December peak, respiratory illness is trending back down in Virginia. And in a special Wednesday edition of Our Politics Chat, Jeff Shapiro joins us to discuss Glenn Youngkin's final address as governor. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, January 14th. Scott Beardsley, the University of Virginia's new president, addressed a panel of state lawmakers on Monday. He talked about his background prior to stepping into his role of UVA Business School dean, and he said he was interested in the presidential position because of his love for the university and its mission.
My decisions will be guided by the university's mission and values, and not by partisan politics. Secondly, I recognize the past year has been challenging, and I want to state again that I'm committed to rebuilding trust. That'll take time, transparency, and thoughtful action, but I'm committed to it.
Beardsley said while he has not had time to develop a full strategic plan yet, he wants UVA to lead in, quote, human-centered innovation. Respiratory illness is starting to trend downwards in Virginia after hitting a peak in late December, WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
The Virginia Department of Health currently categorizes respiratory illness activity as moderate in the central and eastern regions of the state and low in the rest. Activity peaked at the end of December, as measured by emergency department or ED visits. At that time, a quarter of all ED visits in the state were for respiratory illnesses. As of last week, that had dropped to 19%. December's peak was slightly lower than those in February 2025 and December 2023. The VDH dashboard shows specific rates for influenza, COVID, and RSV, of which influenza was the most common last week. Flu type A is the most common strain being diagnosed. The overall respiratory illness activity also includes cases of cough, pneumonia, and other diseases.
Everyone over 6 months old is eligible for a flu shot.
Rachel Dumean is a communication specialist for the Central Shenandoah Health District.
Make sure you're washing your hands often and thoroughly throughout the day for at least 20 seconds with warm water and soap. Make sure you're covering coughs and sneezes. If you are able to, staying home or away from others when you are sick.
Children ages 0 to 4 currently have the highest rate of ED visits for respiratory illness. The VDH has received 21 reports of COVID, flu, and RSV-related deaths in the past 6 weeks, with two-thirds being caused by flu and one-third by COVID. There have been no pediatric influenza deaths so far this season. A group of health systems in Central Virginia, including UVA Health and VCU Health, have issued new patient guidance that patients should not delay medical treatment due to symptoms and that those with flu-like symptoms are strongly encouraged to wear a mask when seeking treatment. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
We posted graphs and a link to more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Democrats in the state Senate are putting a spotlight on kitchen table issues. The General Assembly session starts today. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has this preview.
Affordability is the watchword for Senate Democrats who are rolling out an agenda that includes everything from taxing the rich to expanding access to health care. Here's Senate Finance Chairwoman Louise Lucas.
We're going to frame affordability as inseparable from freedom and opportunity. And of course, some of the highlights would include access to quality education, healthcare, affordability and reproductive freedoms, transportation, workforce development, and economic mobility. And I know some folks at the federal level are saying that affordability is just a word. It's more than just a word. Affordability is about what affects working families.
Republicans say Virginia can't afford the agenda of Senate Democrats, criticizing, for example, the new payroll tax that will finance paid family and medical leave. Here's Senator Jennifer Boysko, a Democrat from Herndon.
We are talking about for an average of a $60,000 salary, an individual would pay about $4 a month. That is about the cost of a cup of coffee. I would question the validity of saying that that's going to make things unaffordable.
Republicans aren't really in a position to stop the new payroll tax for paid family and medical leave or any of the proposals on the Democrats' affordability agenda. For the first time in 4 years, Democrats will have a trifecta controlling the House, the Senate, and the executive mansion. I'm Michael Pope.
Governor Glenn Youngkin will make his final State of the Commonwealth address tonight. Radio IQ politics analyst Jeff Shapiro joins Michael to discuss what the outgoing governor's legacy will be.
Now it's time for our current governor, Glenn Youngkin, to start his long goodbye. We're about to say goodbye to Governor Glenn Youngkin, who will cease to be governor on Saturday. Jeff Shapiro, I saw him over the weekend on one of the Sunday shows, basically endorsing J.D. Vance for president. What do we make of that?
Governor Youngkin's term as Virginia chief executive is ending as it began, amid a good deal of national speculation. He made no secret of his curiosity about the Republican presidential nomination when he took office in 2022. And as he readies to leave office in 2026, he goes on Fox, that friendly, non-challenging, right-leaning news source, and says he's cool with J.D. Vance as the nominee for the Republican Party in 2028. Now, this has a lot of people wondering, is he angling for a spot on the ticket, the vice presidential candidate? If that's the case, could he even carry Virginia for the national ticket? Or is he anticipating that Republicans are done for nationally in 2028, that a Democrat will be returned to the White House, that the Virginia curse will fully flare again, and a Republican will be elected governor in 2029, perhaps Glenn Allen Youngkin.
So one thing that we saw from Governor Youngkin is that he really embraced a lot of the Republican culture wars. I'm thinking about demonizing transgender kids. And then he got all worked up that this law school concept of critical race theory was somehow being taught in third grade classrooms. What do we make of this embrace from Glenn Youngkin on all these culture war issues?
You know, some of this is, if you will, MAGA with manners. But to some degree, some of these positions reflected Youngkin's personal conservatism, much of it faith-based. But there was the rewriting of Virginia history, whitewashing, Democrats would say. And then, of course, the hyper-politicization of higher education in league with Trump. This soon-to-be former administration targeted UVA and George Mason University. They got rid of a president at UVA and seemed to have forced out as well the first Black superintendent of the Virginia Military Institute.
So the big picture here for Glenn Youngkin is there are swings and misses. And so the successes for the governor, the outgoing governor, are tax cuts. He was actually successful in getting some tax cuts. He had some mental health reforms that he can tout as successes. He even had a policy of the all of the above energy, embracing all kinds of different energy sources. But then also some pretty significant misses. I'm thinking of that arena in Northern Virginia that never went anywhere. Also, he had like three different school superintendents in the time that he was governor. And then even on energy, you know, when Trump came for the wind farm, he didn't even really say anything. So what do we make of the Glenn Youngkin legacy?
And don't forget, you know, he likes to talk about economic development and job creation and a couple of 100,000 jobs created. And remember, too, it was Glenn Youngkin who fully defended the Elon Musk Doge attack on federal employment, as well as Trump's other targeting of the federal workforce. And in a state where roughly a third of the economy is attributed to federal largesse, his positions were not welcome. And perhaps given that record turnout in Northern Virginia, it shouldn't be a surprise that a Democrat was elected governor in a big sweep that brought along as well 13 new Democratic House members.
All right, that's all the time that we've got for right now, although we will be back later this week. My name is Michael Pope, and we have been joined by politics analyst and UVA scholar Jeff Shapiro. See you at the Capitol.
Looking forward to it.
Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger ran on a promise to improve housing affordability across the Commonwealth. When she takes office this weekend, there will be a myriad of legislative efforts to support that promise. Among them is a bill that would expand the use of manufactured homes. They are quick and easy to build, but carry with them a perception of a mobile home industry that's often unattractive to localities. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner has this report.
I'm walking up to the Dorsey Homes community in Petersburg, a collection of freshly built manufactured homes. Randy Grumbine, executive director of the Virginia Manufactured and Modular Housing Association, is already waiting for me, and he tells me what he'd like to see.
So any place that you can site build a home, you would be able to put a manufactured home. That's as simple as it gets. Right now, manufactured homes are allowed by right only in agricultural zones. So this basically says if you can build a home there, why not be able to place a manufactured home on the same lot?
As an industry, Grumbine said they've dealt with aesthetic stigma for years, and that stigma can be summed up pretty easily. If it comes on wheels, you can't do it. As the industry moved from what Grumbine admitted was lower quality travel trailers in the 50s and 60s to more permanent structures, he said it's gotten better, but the aesthetic of so-called mobile homes has stuck.
This bill will be helpful to open eyes to what the homes are today and to still have an affordable product. It's built in a factory, so it's very efficient, highly energy efficient. It gives the consumers options.
Teresa Steele was among the first families to move into Dorsey. The three-bedroom manufactured home isn't on wheels and looks as nice inside and outside as the other homes. It came in multiple pieces before being attached on site in less than a month, and Steele loves it.
So I'm extra. I'm a designer. I decorate.
You can tell. It's beautiful.
Yes. So I want my face to, and my story to let everyone else know that if I can do it, you can do it. I'm disabled. I don't have a job. I'm on disability. But God kept me here for a reason because I almost died.
Steele survived a brain tumor, among other health issues, was the victim of violence by an ex-lover, but her home costs just over $1,400 a month, including internet and utilities.
I'm blessed, I'm humble, and extremely grateful to be here. I'm a good and special role model for my four beautiful daughters to say, hey, look, mommy has a home now, and I hope I could pass it on to you guys.
The legislative effort to expand manufactured housing is set to come from Democratic Senator Schuyler Van Valkenburg. He described localities' current disdain for manufactured homes as, quote, discriminatory, and his bill would put them in the same category as traditional homes.
If localities are setting up barriers for manufactured homes, which they do, we are taking away one of the lowest cost home ownership options that are available.
Van Valkenburg said similar bills have succeeded in other states, including Kentucky, where it passed last year with nearly unanimous support. But while Van Valkenburg is pushing his bill as a kind of non-discrimination in housing type, it is also a zoning bill, one that will take away authority from localities. And Virginia's preference for local authority may run headlong into his bill's dreams of success. Democratic Senator LaCharisse Aird's district includes the Dorsey community. She's proud to see folks like Steele get a home they can pass on to their kids. But Aird also respects the legislature's preference for local authority. She hasn't seen Van Valkenburg's bill because it hasn't been published yet, but she said she'd be open to negotiations on the idea.
Dorsey Homes is a perfect example of what communities can do when we all get around the table and talk about how to make sure the law supports the flexibility in local communities to move these types of projects forward.
Notably, manufactured homes are getting built in Virginia right now, Grumbine said, with an estimated 2,000 such homes set to be built in Virginia by the end of 2026. But if they can build more, he thinks it could fill gaps that many localities and their residents need.
As seen here in Petersburg, can make a significant difference to have that entry-level workforce housing that is so badly needed across Virginia.
Whether Spanberger and Democratic leadership in both chambers agree remains to be seen. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Finally today, across parts of Appalachia, some people don't trust their water, or their water is not safe to drink, so they turn to bottled water, even for cooking in some cases. But that's costing low-income families a lot of money, Virginia Public Radio's Roxy Todd reports.
Leanne Kremitas is a professor of biological systems engineering at Virginia Tech.
We have noticed that in a lot of rural areas in central Appalachia, people don't trust their home water, and they rely solely on bottled water. And bottled water is incredibly expensive.
She and four other researchers spoke with residents in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. They found those who bought bottled water were spending up to 2,000 times what the average bill is for municipal water. Bottled water costs some families 10 to 20% of their income.
And a lot of times we were sampling in homes where they don't make a lot of money. Like, these are homes where they have a very limited financial income. It's not a luxury. You need water. And if the water coming out of your tap is terrible, you are going to buy bottled water, even if it's an enormous expense.
Across Appalachia, many people live in areas with outdated or poorly maintained water systems, and some rely on well or spring water. In the study, some residents complained about their water's taste or smell. When the researchers tested the water, they found traces of coliform, E. coli, or lead in some homes. Kramitas points out that bottled water isn't great for the environment because of the plastic it produces. And though bottled water tends to have fewer contaminants, it is high in microplastics. In Blacksburg, I'm Roxy Todd.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Wednesday.